I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're continuing the series, The Book That Changed My Life, except that this hour, this book, is not a book. It's a poem.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
Allen Ginsberg's famous beat poem Howl is regarded by many as a literary work that changed American poetry and may have changed America itself. It certainly had an impact on the two poets who are with me this hour, Mark Doty and Jason Schindler. We'll talk with them, but we'd also like to hear from you. Did you hear the call in Ginsberg's Howl? What kind of effect did the poem have on you when you first read it or heard it? And does it have that same effect today? I mean, what is Howl? Is it a piece of literature, an expression of a generation? And again, the question that we're asking all this week. Is there a book or a poem that changed your life, and why? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jason Schindler is joining us from a studio in New York City. He's the editor of a forthcoming book, Howl, 50 years later. Yes, in fact, it has been almost 50 years. Jason's also editing a collection of letters between Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. Jason, thanks a lot for coming in.
You're welcome.
And Mark Doty is here with me in the Connection Studio. He has written numerous books of poetry. His most recent is called School of the Arts. He teaches in the graduate program at the University of Houston, and it's nice to have you here with me as well.
I'm glad to be here, Dick.
How did the poem change you, Mark? We have to go all the way to Tucson, Arizona for an answer there, right?
I was a 16-year-old in suburban Tucson when I came across a copy of Howl. And, of course, I had heard of the poem. It was already a bohemian classic. And I felt swept away not only by the speed and strangeness and wild comedy of the poem, but especially by the kind of life it pointed to. Here I was in the bland niceties of suburban Arizona, and Ginsberg was writing about an urban world full of passion, pleasure, sex, rebellious politics, longing, drugs, an intense kind of political vision that I knew very little about. I was stunned by the kind of door which the poem opened onto other ways of living. I don't know to this day how much of an aesthetic influence Howl is for me, but as a kind of cultural marker, as an indicator of possible ways to live and the kinds of lives that were being lived somewhat invisibly in America, it has no peer.
And Jason, you were a part of Ginsberg's world. What was he like? Was he the poem? Was he the voice of that poem?
Well, in part. I mean, he was a man of great generosity, and I think that allowed him to be empathetic to the voices in those poems, in that poem.
Have so many questions. Yeah. I mean, was he as angry as the poem sounds at time? Was he as sort of wild and loopy and humorous as the poem sounds at time?
Well, when he wrote the poem, he was really, I think, trying to befriend or imitate Jack Kerouac a lot. I'll just read you a note from a letter. He says, "I realize how right you are. That was the first time I sat down to blow. It came out in your method, sounding like you, an imitation practically." So I think he was very much governed by trying to just, as he said, try to express himself, his deepest feelings, and without a poetic self, without a pretense of a poetic self at that time. I think that's what governed a lot of his impulse to get this down.
There's something also, Mark, about that mix of all those emotions at the same time, because for some reason they're not clashing. He takes us on this sort of wild ride, and we're not stopping and going back to read something like, "Hey, he was here there, and now he's here this time," because it moves so quickly.
It's startling, isn't it, that a poem can be full of visionary longing, absurd slapstick comedy, a great rage, at the quality of American life and the fate of Ginsberg's peers, we don't expect those kinds of tones to sit side by side.
Can you give us an example of a part of the poem that you like?
Oh, sure. Listen to this. This is, now, we have to remember that Howell is a great catalog, and almost all of its long, long lines begin with the word who. And we heard a few minutes ago Ginsberg saying, "I saw the best minds of my generation starving, hysterical, naked." So the who are those members of Ginsberg's clan, his tribe, who threw their watches off the roof to cast their ballot for eternity outside of time. And alarm clocks fell on their heads every day for the next decade, who cut their wrists three times successively, unsuccessfully, gave up, and were forced to open antique stores where they thought they were growing old and cried, who burned alive in their innocent flannel suits on Madison Avenue amid blasts of leaden verse and the tanked-up clatter of the iron regiments of fashion and the nitroglycerin shrieks of the fairies of advertising and the mustard gas of sinister intelligent editors, or were run down by the drunken taxicabs of absolute reality. Who jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge, this actually happened, and walked away unknown and forgotten into the ghostly days of Chinatown, soup alleyways, and fire trucks. Not even one free beer.
That's Mark Doty reading from Allen Ginsberg's Howl. And Jason, one of the points that you make about the poem is that for all its sort of frenetic energy that it starts with, it does these really interesting shifts. And a part of the poem that I'm going to ask you to read for us comes after one of those shifts, right?
Yeah. The third section for me always seemed to strike a chord. I was sort of in love with its solidarity after facing a kind of loveless Moloch. And it's a kind of tonic against the Moloch. And that section really is about trying to free Carl Solomon and free the best minds of his generation destroyed by madness. And he offers a kind of notion that an alternative community is possible through the act of contact with one person, that Carl Solomon becomes a symbol also for his mother, who was in a madhouse at the time that Carl Solomon was in one. So that section, the poem, the tone changes, it slows down a bit, and there's a sense of coming to terms with the nightmare that he's outlined for us in the sections 1 and 2.
Would you read it for us?
Sure. "Carl Solomon, I'm with you in Rockland, where you're madder than I am. I'm with you in Rockland, where you must feel very strange. I'm with you in Rockland, where you imitate the shade of my mother. I'm with you in Rockland, where you've murdered your 12 secretaries. I'm with you in Rockland, where you laugh at this invisible humor. I'm with you in Rockland, where we are great writers on the same dreadful typewriter. I'm with you in Rockland, where your condition has become serious and is reported on the radio. I'm with you in Rockland, where the faculties of the skull no longer admit the worms of the senses. I'm with you in Rockland, where you drink the tea of the breasts of the spinsters of Utica. I'm with you in Rockland, where you pun on the bodies of your nurses, the harpies of the Bronx. I'm with you in Rockland, where you scream in a straight jacket that you're losing the game of the actual ping pong of the abyss. I'm with you in Rockland, where you bang on the catatonic piano. The soul is innocent and immortal. It should never die ungodly in an armed madhouse."
That's Jason Schinder also reading from Ginsberg's Howl. It's so musical, Jason, at that point.
Absolutely. The whole poem is an oratory declaration of you know, and certainly musical and
I mean, it's almost like it's meant to be read aloud. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's as if a great uncorking of energy has taken place. Ginsberg said about the poem, I didn't want to write poetry. I just wanted to let it pour out. And clearly what he thought poetry was before that point was something much more conventionally musical, much tighter and more contained. And this is, it's exactly what the title says it is. The howl, the great outrush of lamentation, longing, bitterness, everything. And anything can be included. It feels like a poem that sort of starts rolling like an avalanche and then picks up more and more material as it goes.
And Jason,
one of the great notes about the poem is that it allowed all subject matter to be contained in a poem. I mean, it really didn't hesitate from writing about all of the self, one might say that when he was working and imitating his father, Lewis Ginsberg, who was a poet, there was a sense of writing of the best of the self. And my sense of Ginsberg was he decided at that moment to write about all of the self and not worry about any consequences.
Indeed.
So there's a great deal of permission in the poem for me personally that I enjoy, you know.
Something, Mark, that you wrote a while ago about American poetry, something distinguishing American poetry, is that it does this celebration of the self in ways that other nations don't use poetry.
Well, you know, Howell was composed in 1955, 1956, and the dominant current in American poetry in those days was the influence of T.S. Eliot, who said that poetry ought to be an escape from personality, a way to get away from the self towards what? Eternal verities, cooler abstractions, a calmer position of intellectual activity. This poem has got nothing in it of calm. It does not match Wordsworth's famous definition of poetry as emotion recollected in tranquility. Ginsberg wants to do what Whitman called for, tear the doors off the jams, let it pour out. Let nothing hold you back. And when you think about American culture in the mid-50s, the poem's extraordinary openness is a feat of great courage.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, it is Howl in this hour. We're talking about the wonderful Ginsberg poem with Mark Doty and Jason Schinder. We'd like to hear from you. Does this place have a particular spot in your literary memory? Do you remember the first time you heard it or the first time that you read it? The bigger question, though, for the entire week in the series The Book That Changed My Life, is there a poem or a book that stands apart or separate that you want to tell us about? We'd like to hear that as well. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And in our ongoing series, The Book That Changed My Life, we're taking a little bit of a detour to talk about the poem that changed my life. This hour it is Allen Ginsberg's Howl from 1956. We've heard a little bit. We will hear a little bit more later in the hour. We'd also like to hear from you. Where does this fit? We're going to start in Lincoln, Rhode Island. Glenn's on the line. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
Well, what do you think?
Well, you know, I first came across this poem in seminary when I was doing a study on Ecclesiastes, and it just opened my life up to this alternative community of reality that I just had never been exposed to being a poor kid from Appalachia.
I'm encouraged that it was being taught in seminary.
Well, it wasn't. I found it by Thomas Merton, so...
Well, then, you know, it makes complete sense because Ginsberg is, of course, drawing his big, long-lined cadences out of Whitman, and Whitman is drawing those cadences out of the Old Testament. So the kind of rolling, forceful outcry of Old Testament verse is very much present as an influence here.
Are you a minister now, Glenn?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm a Baptist minister, and I actually use it. I use it this spring for a baptism class with some 12 and 13-year-olds.
Which part of the poem did you use?
Well, I put the whole thing illegally on a CD, and I passed it out to them.
How did the kids react to it?
The kids liked it. The parents weren't too happy, but just from some of the rough parts of the poem. But, you know, I kind of gave them a little forethought on it. But,
quick, last one. Why did you want them to read this poem for that class?
You know, I think the first part, that first line, you know, the best minds of my generation starving, hysterical, naked, that... just for them to look around, and I don't think they have to look very far just to see madness and minds that are starving. Mm-hmm. And that if they could just somehow get a glimpse on this alternative reality, that there's different ways of living life than just in this kind of mass consumerist culture, I was hoping that that's what that poem would convey to them.
And Jason, you are reliving all this for the book that you're planning on putting out next year, Howl 50 Years Later. Does the language to you have that same ring of truth, that same sort of penetration today that it did when you first heard it?
Absolutely. I think part of the reason it stays that way for me is there's a sense of discovery in the poem all the way through it. Allen seems to be almost coming to see his consciousness. And I'm always amazed at its vibrant lyrical tenderness, and it's almost, Allen said he wanted the poem to have a physical impact on people, that you wouldn't necessarily read it, but that you would experience it.
The
and I think
Go ahead.
I was going to add there, Jason, the last time that I heard Alan read, it was at the Geraldine Dodge Poetry Festival, very late in his life. There was a day devoted to high school students. They had come from all over the state of New Jersey, and there were kids chasing Alan around those fields to get his autograph. So excited.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful to see that 14, 16, 17-year-olds are as passionate about those texts now as I think they've been since the day they were published.
Well, Mark, you know, and Mark wrote an essay for this book, and in it he talks about the strange way in which what Alan was able to say to high school teachers and students was quite unique, and that still today we don't have that ability to speak so graphically about our sexual or erotic life.
I was astonished.
And somehow Alan was... Somehow
this is like
Alan
the Ode to the Sphincter was
absolutely
a poem that he was reading to high school teachers, and they were eating it up.
They
right?
loved it.
Exactly.
And I was listening thinking, now, if I tried to do this, I don't think that I would be invited to read for this audience again.
Yeah, he loved to shock that. He loved to read those poems, and something about his ability to embody the poem, made the poem, acceptable.
Yeah, made it work, made it believable. David in San Francisco, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, and it's totally appropriate. 1957, I came to San Francisco from Minneapolis, Minnesota, on the behest of Howell, looking for community. It was not only Howell, but also an article by Kenneth Rexroth, a predecessor,
sure,
and a man who opened the door, who wrote that something in Nation Magazine, 1957, February 20, that something was happening in San Francisco, and mentioned Howell and Jack Kerouac, that brought me there, and I'm still here to this day. In fact, just this weekend, I was with... I remember the secret hero of NC, Neil Casti. I was just with Neil Casti's son, Jamie, here in San Francisco, in North Beach. But it all began with Howell, 1957, and I'm still here.
Neil Casti is Dean Moriarty, right?
He's Dean Moriarty, but he's also NC, the secret history of this poem, secret hero of this poem, Howell. And he had a big effect because he was the mover and shaker. He was the wild guy that they followed out of Columbia University to get on that road that we're still on to this day, 1957.
And on the road that you're on, David, do you go back to this poem? Is it still a part of that?
Well, it's definitely in my mind. It takes me right back to those days. And in fact, I went back to Minneapolis, and turned out you could read it. And Bob Dylan became the kind of connection between Bob Dylan just down from Hibbing, Minnesota, and I was the guy who turned Bob Dylan on to the Beats, to Howell, in fact. And I was in San Francisco. I was there at Mike's Pool Hall when Jack Kerouac came running in, holding in his hand. I just got it. That was a few months later. And he had a copy of On the Road in his hand. And they all came, and they all got together. Ellen came up a few months later, back to San Francisco, and there you be.
We will be talking about that on Friday, but David, I want you to just close your eyes. Come with me to Chicago, 1959.
Storefront boroughs of T-head, joyride neon, blinking traffic light, sun and moon and tree vibrations in the roaring winter dusks of Brooklyn, ashcan rantings and kind king light of mind, who chained themselves to subways for the endless ride from Battery to Holy Bronx on Benzedrine until the noise of wheels and children brought them down, shuddering mouth racked and battered, reek of brain all drained of brilliance in the drear light of zoo.
The drear light of zoo. Something I didn't remember, Jason, was that how much he invented words, right?
Absolutely. I mean, he wanted in every line. He used to talk about wanting in every line, some reality, surrealism, improvisational, mythification, comedy. He really tried in every line to have this kind of vortex.
He loves
that
to echo,
sort of explode.
Yeah, he loves to echo older verse as well. You can hear in that drear light of zoo. It sounds like Blake, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
There are
yeah.
beautiful repetitions of archaic diction, of poetic speech from the poets Ginsberg loves.
And, just go back to that caller. You talk about the impact of how, one of his impacts is certainly in its action, its ability to create community. I mean, it really stimulated an alternative community. Burt Rutger, in his essay in this book, talks about that, and many of the poets who write talk about how it opened a gate for them.
One of the things I find really interesting, Jason, is that for all the sort of physicality in the poem, this feeling that it just appeared on one day, this man went through months of rewrite and carefully shaping this, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. The poem had about 18 drafts to it over a long period of time, but not necessarily that long given other poems. But when you think about it, the poem did not come burst out. Alan had two books before this that he had completed, the kind of verse that Mark was talking about. He was working very hard on trying to develop his aesthetic, own his imagination. His letters to Kerouac were very much about being a great writer.
What are you saying, Mark? And that it maybe not have been, it may have been more spontaneous than that?
I'm thinking about a famous distinction that Robert Lowell made between the poetry of the raw and the poetry of the cooked. And he saw himself, of course, as a cooked poet whose work was highly refined, sophisticated, made use of traditional form. And Ginsberg as being a great example of a raw poet where the words tumble out onto the page. And whether they're really spontaneous or not, it seems clear to me that Ginsberg wants them to feel spontaneous, mm-hmm. as if nothing here is premeditated or carefully considered, but we're trusting the immediate reaction of the self to time, to the moment.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us as we talk about Allen Ginsberg's Howl and invite you to talk about a book or a poem that changed your life. Next to Andover, Massachusetts, Nicole is with us. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
So where do you fit in this?
Well, first of all, I want to say I bought a copy of Howl at a tag sale when I was about 14 years old in the early 80s and set about trying to read it on my own. And as a girl who was 14 with not a whole lot of life experience, it was really overwhelming and it scared me. And then I think as an adult, I later came back to it with a little more experience of the world and felt a lot more like I could get into the poem and understand a little bit more what's going on. But as a female reading the poem, I think it's very different than reading it as a man.
Why did it scare you?
I think the...
Was it the explicitness of the sexual language that...
Yeah, definitely it was that. Yeah. It just struck me as... it was probably something I had no experience with, obviously, at 14. And just the powerful language around the sexual and around... the sort of blatant maleness and power of that as a young girl caught me off guard and affected me in sort of a intimidating way. But I also admired it and felt like I was thinking about, at that point, becoming a poet and trying to write poetry myself and trying to figure out what do I have to say. And it seemed like, wow, a person could say all of that in... And I knew it was an important poem, and I wanted to be smart.
So it was kind of like
the... understand it.
Was it the genuineness of the language that then brought you back to it instead of just sort of setting it aside as something not for me?
Yes, I think so. And I think also, as someone was just mentioning earlier, that later in life at the Dodge Festival, I did see and hear Allen Ginsberg in person, mm-hmm. and it had, of course, an enormous impact on me, just seeing and hearing the voice of an actual person and understanding it, that it was, you know, bringing the human being who wrote the poem before my eyes was a major impact. But I also have a question for Mark, who was my poetry teacher for a lovely semester at Sarah Lawrence College a long time ago.
Hi.
Hi, Mark. It's Nicole Butterfield.
Hi, Nicole.
Remember me. Hi.
What a nice surprise.
I was wanting to ask you what you think about Howl in the context of our culture that is so exposed and so about telling all.
Mm-hmm.
In 2005, when people are, you know, on television, you know, we're watching people have plastic surgery.
Sure.
What is poetry? What could poetry do now in our culture that's not equivalent, but in a similar way? How does a poet approach the world and try to tell the truth about human experience when we're so involved culturally in exposing our human experience.
Go for it, Mike.
Well, you're absolutely right that, you know, our culture has changed so radically. And the stuff of wild and naked confession in Howl is now the ho-hum fodder of the daily talk show. It doesn't startle us anymore, not in the same way. His language may startle us. And certainly Ginsberg's tone stays startling because he's writing a poem of the quest for transcendence through sex that keeps turning into a comedy. And we don't expect sex to become, especially sex with a religious bent, to become comic. So he's still doing strange things. In our moment, you know, we've heard so much about the secret life of the self, telling our stories. And it seems like what is crucial for poets to do is to find ways for our stories to connect, that we don't stop at revealing our own lives. We don't say, this poem is important because it happened to me. A poem has to do more than simply open a door on the private life of the self.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Jason, you know, one of the things that we haven't, I don't think, quite placed well enough here in terms of reminding us of the context within which Alan wrote this and read it for the first time was that sort of gray flannel Cold War fear that was so much a part of the 1950s and how it had this country so buttoned down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was a strange moment that this poem would take shape out of the 1950s politics and but Alan, deliberately created a kind of community out there that I think supported his efforts to go forward with this. You know, the question the woman asked, if I might.
Yeah, sure.
Ask, you know, Alan has a note here. He says, I keep thinking I would like to be able to write another Howl. You know, like taking the problems of the 80s, like ecology and the moral majority and all that. But, you know, you can't do that deliberately. It has to come accidentally, almost. And I've been often worrying, thinking about why hasn't there been another Howl, so to speak.
What do you think about that? Do you think that in part because of what Nicole and Mark were talking about, that it would not have the same kind of bright paint splash in this society?
I think partly it has to do something with ambition, with a writer's sense of being able to take on America and the underside of our culture. I think a lot of us have become looking at a more of an immediate world out of which we write. And Alan's world really was much larger from the beginning. There's one possible reason. I don't know. Mark, what's your sense of that?
Well, I'm struck by the people talking about the way the poem created a sense of community and that people could come together around this particular outcry, this generational song. And it strikes me that the younger people who respond to the poem, I mean, myself included, reading it, in the mid to late 1960s, felt a kind of nostalgia for that possibility of community, that part of what we loved in the poem was the sense that there had been something to join. And it seems to me that in America now that's much less of a possibility. In our mass culture, where the alternative, the hip, the outré, immediately becomes a style and is promptly marketed.
It seems in many ways like whatever there was to join may have ended in the late 60s, early 70s, right? I mean, if it began, Jason, with the Beats and that kind of morphed into an anti-war, free love hippie thing that went on through the 1960s, then that just sort of fell apart, didn't it?
I don't like to think that, but it might be true that happened. But of course, you know, one never is one never knows what communities can develop and what can happen because this sort of one would have never guessed that Alan would meet Jack and Burroughs and from that, you know, nature of influence that happened there, that they would develop their visions and go forward and write. So,
at this moment, it's certainly true that poets are more interested in private meaning than in communal
statement. But there's no reason to think that's going to stay the same.
Is Michael Moore a Howl of 2004? I mean, is that where you try to find this now, perhaps in other media? I don't know. I mean,
I asked Michael about this. He said it hadn't been too much of an influence.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, where does the next Howl come from? There's a question for you to join us on. Well, just your reaction to the poem, how it has put us where we are today. And if you want to bring another poem to the table or another book that changed your life, we are open to your call at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Mark Doty is here with me in The Connection studio. He is the author of 7 books of poetry, including Atlantis, Source, and his newest collection, School of the Arts. He's also the author of a number of nonfiction works, including the memoir, Heaven's Coast. He teaches literature at the University of Houston, and he's one of the contributors to a forthcoming book, Howl, 50 Years Later, which is being edited by Jason Schinder, who's my other guest. Jason's joining us from a studio in New York. His most recent book of poetry is Among Women. He's also founder of the YMCA's National Writer's Voice. Mark and Jason are here to help us with our conversation about Allen Ginsberg's Howl. We'd like to have your thoughts on that poem. We're going to go to Norwood, New York, and Carl is joining us. Hi, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. Briefly, Howl saved my life. I was 21 in 1969, just out of college, engaged, and had already resigned myself to a life as the man in the gray flannel suit. And it rescued me from that life by showing me other ways to look at so-called reality. I read it, and since then, 37 years ago, my life has been, if there is such a thing, the good right side of Howl. The curiosity, the unexpected, the serendipity, the unpredictable, the little encounters that almost didn't happen, like turning the radio dial until you hear something that makes you say, "What is that?" that you almost didn't even turn on. It's the thing around the corner. You know, it's the next sight on the road or the smell of the bakery a block away that travels on the wind. Howl rescued me from a life I'd already prepared myself for as an executive, 3-piece suit, briefcase, boardroom, and crap, and made life fascinating. And pushing 60 now, Howl has kept me creative and young.
You know, I ask the question in an almost flip way. Let me finish. You know, has this changed your life, or has this book changed your life? And what you're telling me is that in a really substantial way, this has had a huge influence on you.
Massive. And the thing is, to address the thought that you put out a short while ago, sir, latter-day Howl people, latter-day Ginsbergs, Lord Buckley was a Ginsberg, and latter-day, Joe Frank is a Ginsberg. The people who realize that poetry, one of the best duties of poetry, is to say a lot in a little and be a shorthand and a code and a trigger for the human thought process.
I'm wondering, Jason, if the poem had anything to do with your own decision to become a poet in much the way that Carl is describing it now.
No, I love that story, and I'd love to, you know, get his address, because those stories are quite striking around the country. I get letters from people who were in the Army, and they had this kind of secret book they were passing around, almost pornographically, a book. But for me, no, I fell in love with poetry pretty early, but I wrote to Alan to study with him in the Roper Institute that he co-founded with Ann Waldman, and to my mother's horror, he said yes. And so I found myself at the Roper in the summers. And I think he just confirmed that one could participate in the life of poetry, and that the genius of genius was sort of knowing your genius, and that if you could find your own imagination, you might have some joy with it. He seemed quite abundant with his own with his own genius. I would say also that So he gave me a lot of support by being able to be around him and observe him and work with him. I worked with him on several books and texts. And, you know, Alan created the character that Hal reinforced and that people wanted. And he lived with it and he was trapped in it and he was lonely in it. But he served it very well.
We will and make sure that that we get you and Carl connected up without going through sort of the business of zip codes on the radio here. But the poetry, Ginsberg pops up in your poetry. I mean, there are Ginsbergian lines in Doty's poetry, are there not?
His energy is generative, and something about the headlong speed of his juxtapositions, the way he evokes, especially urban landscapes. He's a great city poet. Mm. And so I've found myself, particularly in moments when I want to get at some quality of the sort of beauty we find in urbanity, in the wreckage of our cities. I think Ginsberg is probably a ghost behind some of those lines.
Read us just a couple of lines, if you would, then.
Sure, a little bit from a poem called Homo Will Not Inherit. And this is actually a description of downtown Providence about a dozen years ago, a very battered urban locale. Shimmered azaleas of gasoline between the steam and the ruin of the Cinema Paris, marquee advertising its own milky vacancy, broken showcases sealed, ticket booth a hostage wrapped in tape and black plastic, captive in this zone of black-fronted bars and bookstores where there's nothing to read but longing's repetitive texts, where desires unpoliced or nearly so. Someone's posted a Xeroxed headshot of Jesus, permed, blonde, blurred at the edges as though photographed through a greasy lens, and inked beside him in marker strokes, Homo will not inherit. Repent and be saved.
When I listen to the link between that and Ginsberg's, something else comes up, and it's like the clarity of seeing. It's the descriptive eye is a key part of it. Just hearing you read that and having it take me to that street in Providence, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, and Ginsberg does exactly the same thing. There's this, it's a collision of images, but they're pretty sharp. You know, he gets them.
There's something about collision, about collage itself, that makes us see things, doesn't it? If you put shimmered azaleas of gasoline, you know, you put azaleas and gasoline together, something happens in the mind of the perceiver. And this is something Ginsberg uses masterfully. Those quick, rushing montage effects create a sensory experience for the reader or the listener. Maybe especially for the listener, because hearing Ginsberg this morning, I found myself, I want to read this poem like Allen Ginsberg would read it. Yeah, I love that sound.
Let's go back to our callers, to Hebron, New Hampshire. Mark's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking.
I first have a line that sticks out of Hal that really, I think, speaks to what really spoke to me when I first read it and upon, you know, many tested readings afterwards. And it's the beginning of part two, and the line is, what sphinx of cement and aluminum bashed open their skulls and ate up their brains and imagination. And that line really taught me, in my own interpretation of the poem, that I see a triumvirate of epic poems that are linked together in theme and voice and really prophecy. And it would be Blake's America, Whitman's Leaves of Grass, and Ginsberg's Howl. And I think those three are really, really important to not only, you know, read once and look at and be inspired by, but go back and study, because Ginsberg himself is pleading for the voices and the ghosts of Whitman and Blake to rush into him as he's writing, not necessarily in Howl, but in other poems. And I think that, you know, trying to find out where a new Howl will come from is almost impossible, because Ginsberg, I'm sure, had no idea why it came to him, and the inspiration was there, but you can see that the work was there too. And even though he was a beat man, he obviously put in the hours and hours and hours of scrutiny over each line. And I think that everything he says and the previous two poets I mentioned, we need to pay attention to now more than ever. And I can take the comments off the line.
Interestingly,
yeah, go ahead, Jason.
Those books were certainly influences. Alan was influenced by them, certainly, and and Christopher Smart and Cezanne and lots of other people at the time he was writing the book. So
there's a quote of Ginsberg's that I read, Jason, I'm stealing this from you, where he refers to Howell as, quote, an emotional time bomb that would continue exploding in U.S. consciousness. Ego trouble here,
No.
He knew he had something.
That's a characteristic of visionaries, you know, and that's probably certainly true of Blake and true of Whitman, that they believed that their poems would be found and that they would make a difference. This is the poet as Jeremiah standing outside the walls of the city, condemning what goes on there, standing outside his own culture, her own culture, naming the difficulties. And that position seems to bring a certain kind of poetic faith with it. I will be heard.
And did he change then U.S. poetry? Did he change poetry in this country? Can you go back to the early 60s and say, you know, well, after Ginsberg and after the wild language of the Beats, this is where poetry goes? Did it lose that buttoned-down, cool irony of T.S. Eliot that you're talking about?
Well, it lost the irony, but I would be reluctant to pin this to a single cause, because I think literary history, like the rest of history, doesn't usually work that way. Howell is part of a wave of change.
Right.
It's a very early part of the wave. But the kinds of things that Robert Lowell did in Life Studies, where a poet who had a different kind of sort of academic literary credibility was talking openly about his life, was also enormously influential. What was happening in the New York School, poets like Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery, who were loosening things up, allowing chatter and humor and digressive thinking onto the page. So there was a whole movement taking place on the fringes to shake American poetry loose from its complacency.
Jason.
Yes.
Would you think that it made a big difference? Do you think it's part of a movement as Mark's describing it? How do you place it? How do you mark it?
I mark it in the same fashion the nature of its influence is hard to specifically itemize. I mean, you could see in some poets the influence, in some others it's really about the permission it gave them to move forward. But I would be also reluctant to claim it as the breaking point from which American poetry changed. I just think its nature of influence continues, not only with American poetry, but in people's lives.
Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island, for a call from Senya. Did you listen to a description of the street that you recognize, Senya?
Yeah. Hi, nice to meet you all. I'm Senya. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island. Actually, I go to Brown. I'm 18 years old. I don't know, I'm probably among the youngest people listening to this program or calling in. I'm actually just took a class with Robert Creeley this past semester.
Lucky.
Yeah, but he died a few months ago, which was very sad. But I guess I wanted to call in and talk about my experience with Howell, because I came to this country when I was 4 or 5 years old. I immigrated from Colombia, and growing up especially, I grew up in New Jersey, actually very close to Paterson, where Allen Ginsberg was born. And I guess as an immigrant coming to this country, I felt very alienated and all the, things that people feel when they're not from this country. And I stumbled upon Howell when I was, I think, maybe in ninth grade in high school. And it just broadened my entire experience of life. And
What was it about the poem? Do you remember one reaction to it, Senya?
Yeah, it was just, at first, I think the first reaction was I was just in awe of the fact that someone could write like this, because previously, in my, studies of English literature, I'd read Poe and I guess more,
Was it the language that you're talking about, the use of words that you weren't finding elsewhere, or was it the way that he wrote, the sort of almost sort of violent, exuberant poetry?
I think, yeah, if anything, it was more like celebratory, I guess, like chaotic. The idea, Nietzsche said that, I say unto you, one must have chaos in oneself to give birth to a dancing star, and I really think that this poem was that dancing star that Nietzsche was talking about. And also, you previously discussed how Ginsberg was influenced by Whitman. And I know there's this portion of Song of Myself that says, you know, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. And Howell really is like a comforting, it's just comfortable with the idea that you're large, that we are chaotic, that, you know, we are experiencing this world, and it's comfortable with the idea that contradictions are part of everyday life.
Senya, I want to thank you for your call. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-TALKS, the number to join us. Mark Daugherty, one of the things that you've observed about Howell is that the language that is scandalous, that the erotic nature has an almost, the erotic language has an almost sacred quality to it. And I was curious to know how you put the two of them together, sacred and erotic.
Well, Ginsberg is striving for some sense of meaning beyond that button-down, hollow world defined by the marketplace, defined by the Cold War and the Eisenhower era. And one of the places you look for that meaning is in the body, the joys of the body. So he's always trying to find these moments of moving past limitation in the flesh. But it seems like whenever that happens in this poem, it fails. It becomes, an unhappy moment. It becomes a pratfall, a slapstick. You know, earlier we read that line about, who vote through their wristwatches off the roof to vote for eternity and were hit on their heads with alarm clocks every day for the rest of their life. You know, these gestures towards transcendence in this poem are always falling apart. Senya had a really good point there about this poem's marriage of order and chaos. And so desire seems always met with some kind of failure that the poet laughs about. The attempt to find a visionary understanding of reality is always unraveling, and that it keeps trying again and again. That's probably partly responsible for this terrific quality of energy that the poem has, because it never comes to rest in a single emotional tone or a singular point of view. It keeps searching and searching and moving and digging and driving.
Did he speak the same way that he wrote, Jason, when you think back to the time that you spent with him? Was there that same energy, that same vibrancy in the man himself?
At times, my conversations with him were, I think it informed his dialogue with people, but I didn't see the Howl in the man when I spoke to him, per se. Or, you know, he was very generous and deliberate and listening and very specific. If I went down the street to buy a cup of soda, he'd tell me who to meet for 12 people. You know, so, you know, he was wasn't carrying his that voice with him in daily life.
Jason, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Jason Schinder is the editor of the forthcoming book, Howell, 50 Years Later. Watch for it next spring. And Mark Doty is a poet and teacher of literature at the University of Houston. Mark, it's been nice to have you here as well.
Always a pleasure.
Mark's new collection of poetry is called School of the Arts. You can be part of our forum on the series The Book That Changed My Life by going to our website. We are at theconnection.org. Tomorrow we'll talk with the novelist Richard Ford about Walter Percy's book, The Moviegoer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.